Hi, this is Chris Kepler with Does This Happen to You? The weekly podcast where we explore our daily anomalies, bringing to life short stories by fantastic writers never heard in audio format. A weekly mini audiobook about life and befuddlement just for you. This week, we have another episode of Paramedic Notes from the Inside. And here is Scalpels, Needles, Tubes, and $80 Steak, Part 1. Is everything okay in the restaurant? Did someone die? Asked the tall, somewhat geeky security officer who has the elevator on hold for us when we arrive. Our guess is as good as yours, I smile and lie. Miss, I just need to say you look great in that uniform. He laughs and says to Bree, a little too enthusiastically since his donkey-like brain clearly wasn't intended. Elliot, is it? Bree asks even more enthusiastically, tracing his name tag with her eyes, followed several seconds later with a flat. Well, Elliot, that was just completely unnecessary. As the elevator closes on this stammering security officer, I think to myself that security guard is going to be the peak career moment for Elliot if that was any indication of his people skills. Then I whistle at my partner and tease her on her ability to castrate with a comment. Second one today, Black Swan. Watch out, I'm looking for a third. She narrows her eyes and faux punches me in the nuts. Our late-day giddy banter is rudely interrupted by the buzz of our pagers informing us we now have call information. Pager update. ICU 238, you are headed to E22 Grill on the 65th floor of the Trading Exchange building on a Delta-level response for a male, approximately 55 years old. Patient was found in the men's room in severe respiratory distress. Patient is now unresponsive. I'm unable to get breathing and pulse status via bystanders. It appears to be quite chaotic in there. E22 hostess Ellen will meet you on arrival and bring you to the patient. I have FD rolling. Bree looks at me and asks, and Elvis? Probably, I respond. Some reading this may know, but an Elvis is EMS slang for someone who has a heart attack or cardiac arrest while sitting on the toilet. Thus, the term Elvis, referencing how the king himself died and was found a short time later, dead, on the john, his pants at his ankles. Brief memories of a lecture in paramedic school run through my head. Heart attacks which occur during defecation are, in many cases, the result of using the unnatural sitting posture for waste elimination. Excessive straining and oft-repeated straining may produce a vasovagal episode, resulting in fainting and, in some cases, death. As we hit the 65th floor, and as my ears pop for the second time, I think there likely may be a family that won't be having a great Christmas this year. Stepping out into the lobby of the most expensive restaurant in the city, I realized dispatch wasn't kidding with the sounds a little chaotic update. A young auburn-haired woman, amusingly out of place in her far too sophisticated dress for her fresh, off-the-undergrad campus looks and demeanor, is waiting for us. Ellen! I say like I've known her for years. Yes, come with me, he's in here. My manager is with him, Ellen says. The inflection on the last words of her sentences makes me wonder if she is telling me or asking me. So nice of you to make it. What were you doing, getting donuts? Says the jittery woman in her one-size-too-small power suit. This must be my lucky day, I think, as I notice some fine white powder under both her nostrils. In one of those rare moments of comedic genius and timing, without looking at her, I rub my finger under my nose and say, Miss Sum. I don't have to even look at Bree to know she is silently grinning. Ellen rolls her eyes, looks at us, and whispers, Don't even get me started on her. As she bustles along in front of us, leading past the main dining room, down a hall past the washrooms, and into one of several private dining rooms. Stepping through an archway, I am taken aback at the sight of the 24-foot ceilings and bank of floor-to-ceiling windows that look out onto the midwinter sunset blanketing my city, some 65 floors below. "This way," Ellen says as she hurries us into the private washroom area with a row of three sinks on gleaming granite countertops, L'Occitane cleansers and moisturizers in abundance. A 10-seat whirlpool tub occupies the back half of the room. This washroom alone is bigger than my apartment, and I have yet to even see a toilet. Ellen takes care of that as she opens the door that holds said toilet. This is also the room where we find our patient. As the clusterfuck of hysteria and screeching voices rages behind me, I immediately go to the patient who is surrounded by even more power suits, male and female, all in the tiny stall. "Get back, please," I say evenly, with full confidence that between my tone and the navy jumpsuit with the neon yellow reflective striping, even the most aggressive type A asshole will move when I tell him to. They do. They always do. "Okay, who can tell me what happened here? One person only, please," I hear Bree say in the background. As Bree is busy getting an initial history that may give us a clue as to why this man is apparently unconscious on the floor in a toilet stall, I get to work. In seconds, I've determined that our patient is unresponsive to both auditory and physical stimuli, as evidenced by his complete lack of response to my knuckles on his sternum. He is breathing, but the quality of his respiration varies from shallow to gasping and extremely stertorous. In lay terms, that means noisy. I also note, as I crouch beside him, that I smell what is a strong stench of alcohol wafting from the slightly overweight, yet impeccably groomed white man with a manicured mustache. I note he is wearing what time, experience, and a reputation as a clothes horse are telling me is a custom-made, dark gray cashmere suit. I also know watches, as my father was a collector, so I can't help but notice his blue and gold vintage Rolex Submariner, a watch that sells for well over $18,000. However, whatever it is this guy does, and whoever he might be, is, at the moment, irrelevant. The only thing that matters to me right now is that he is rapidly losing his airway, an airway that, since he is unresponsive, he is unable to maintain on his own. Without intervention, that being a definitive airway, he'll likely be dead in less than 3 minutes. In the middle of deftly organized chaos, I run through my mental checklist of options. From the UCLA Pre-Hospital Institute Manual of Critical Care, a definitive airway is defined as the placement of a cuffed endotracheal tube in the trachea past the vocal cords. Definitive airways are indicated whenever a patient cannot protect their own airway, cannot effectively ventilate, and when paralysis is indicated for patient protection, e.g., presumed head injury, rapid sequence induction intubation. Once the decision has been made that a patient requires definitive airway management, there is no going back. You must be confident with both the decision to proceed and your skills to recover the airway. But first, we need to move him. "Hey, you two get his legs and you two get his arms," I tell four of the power suits standing around outside the toilet room. They do as they're told, and out of the toilet he comes. On my direction, they place him in the center of the room on the floor. We're going to need room to work. I then tell each of the suits to take up a position at the four corners of the room and keep anyone but my partner and I and the FD when they get here back. It's always slightly amusing to see four high-power businessmen, roughly my age, who wouldn't give me the time of day if we passed on the street, immediately jump at my blunt and without explanation directions. As I expected, our patient has now stopped breathing entirely. Throwing the ECG leads on the man's chest, I say to Bree, "I need you to prep a 7.5 tube. What's the story?" It sounded like he choked. Bank, private party, several glasses of wine, eating a ribeye, coughed, and ran to the washroom. His secretary followed and found him unconscious.
"Fix him! Don't have a fucking gossip session!
Do you know who he is?" Power suit with the coke under her nose yells at us. "Just take him to the hospital already! Isn't that your job to drive the ambulance?" Cokehead is the secretary, I take it. As Bree hands me my equipment, she calls over Ellen, the hostess, and as if talking to her best girlfriend says, "Can you be a love and get your manager to remove that annoying cougar? We can't work with her screeching at us like that." "Yes, right away," Ellen says, smiling as she scurries off. But it is as I prepare to slide the curved, blunt laryngoscope into the man's mouth, sweeping his tongue to the side to expose his trachea and vocal cords, that Bree tells me the name of our patient, a name that I instantly recognize as being the CEO of one of this country's top financial institutions. In Canada, this man is a household name. Then, as I always do, I place that info into a neat and tidy box, shoving it to the back of my mind. On this job, you have to compartmentalize. "Well, if this works, I know who to go to for a mortgage," I say to Bree, my wise-ass comment strictly an attempt at balancing out what are rapidly rising nerves. "Don't forget who your partner is," she smiles back. "Give me a countdown, please," I ask. "Now." I have roughly 60 seconds to establish an airway by placing an endotracheal tube into the patient's trachea, hooking the tube up to an oxygen delivery system, confirming placement of the tube via an end-tidal CO2 detector monitor, and then begin to breathe for him via what is known as a bag/valve mask device. When Bree gives me the 15-second mark, I already know we are in serious trouble. "Cricoid pressure, please." Bree places a finger on each side of the patient's Adam's apple and slightly pushes forward. Normally, this should allow the vocal cords to come into view and open them slightly to allow me to pass the tube if the patient has very anterior anatomy. This man does not have anterior anatomy. What he has is what appears to be a fistful-sized chunk of $80 ribeye shoved into his windpipe. "Forceps, please," I say without breaking my sight line onto where his vocal cord should be opening up. Inserting the forceps confirms what I already suspect. The stake is too far down to manually remove. "Shit," I say to no one in particular. "You want the Crike kit?" "Yes." "Alan, what's your AS ratio?" Bree asks. 0. "You?" 0. What Bree has just asked me is code. Code, as no one else should really hear two critical care paramedics discuss how many attempts versus successful attempts they have had when performing a surgical cricothyroidotomy. Because between my partner and I, neither one of us has ever had a successful outcome with this procedure, because neither of us has ever done this procedure. The morgue on a training cadaver 5 years ago hardly counts. As Bree preps his neck with betadine solution, briskly wiping away the cold brown liquid with alcohol pads in large concentric circles, I take a long, slow breath. I don't count to 10, as there is simply no time. Holding the scalpel in my right hand, stabilizing with my left, I make a 4-centimeter incision through 3 layers of skin directly over his cricothyroid membrane. I'm thrilled to announce the Does This Happen to You series is now featured Tuesdays on Tribulation Saints Podcast Radio. I've included a link in my show notes. Several podcasts per day, one is sure to ring your bell.